Today I want to speak with you about crop diversity, its conservation and availability. Once we get the technical things sorted out. Genetic resources, its conservation, availability. And I'd like to do that very much from a global perspective. So in keeping with that, let's start with where we are today. No country on earth is self-reliant in terms of its food system. Not only are 131 out of 196 countries net food importers, but most countries depend on their food system for crops that are non-indigenous. Let me flip through a couple of slides here, and I want to use the example of Zimbabwe. We all know the example of the United States. If we had to subsist on crops that were native to the United States, domesticated here, it would be a rather meager diet. But very often we think that developing countries are in a different kind of boat from us, and that's not true. So here's the example of Zimbabwe. And I'm just going to show you where the main foods that comprise the diet in Zimbabwe actually come from. Well, you get the picture. And this is not atypical. Most countries are in this same situation. The United States, Ghana, Italy, all about equally dependent in terms of their diet on foods that originated elsewhere. But if you look at if you go down a little bit farther, a little bit under the surface, you'll also see that the varieties of the different crops are also dependent on source material from elsewhere. Doug Gollan at Williams College did a survey a few years ago of rice varieties that had been produced from the 1960s in the Rice International Rice Network. There had been some 1,700 that had been released by national programs in those years, and only something like 170 were constructed with pedigrees using in-country materials exclusively, and that, I suppose, would be not going back too far in the pedigree. Also, if you go one step beyond that, you'll find out that countries are interdependent, or at least not self-reliant, in terms of their gene bank systems. No country has more than a fraction of what it has needed in the past or will need in the future. So let's take a look at that. Here's a table that looks at the percentage of gene bank accessions of different major crops held by those particular countries, large national gene banks. And as you can see, there are a couple of large numbers on the screen, China holding 22% of the number of accessions held globally for rice. Brazil, 18% of the cassava. But by and large, the numbers are reasonably small for the largest gene banks in the world. The question you might want to ask then for the United States, the bottom row there, is to what extent is the United States or another country in a similar situation happy with basing its maize production in the future on having 8% of the number of samples held in gene banks? If you were to look at smaller countries, here's what Zambia holds. It's really almost invisible. Small national gene bank holding a minute portion of the global collection of those particular crops. Now, this, I think, behooves us to ask, well, what is the state of these genetic resources in the different gene banks. And as Steve mentioned, in the mid-1990s, I was involved working with FAO in making the first United Nations assessment of the state of the world's plant genetic resources. At that time, there were about 1,500 gene banks in the world. At least that was what FAO gave us as a list of gene banks. The top 10% of those gene banks in terms of size were all the gene banks that held 7,400 accessions or more. The median was 650. Most of those gene banks were, frankly, in a deplorably substandard situation. I could show you photograph after photograph, but I think you can imagine the kind of situation that was taking place in this particular gene bank. The countries themselves were reporting, on average, that half of their collection needed to be regenerated. In other words, half had declined below the acceptable rates of viability and needed to be rescued because essentially we were losing diversity and the samples were dying. Many of the countries were self-reporting that they had a 100% regeneration need. The materials, the gene banks were, to be honest, often poorly managed, poorly curated, poorly equipped. And there was a huge amount of overduplication when viewed globally. Here is a graph showing the number of samples in gene banks over time, from about 2 million in the early 80s to just recently a bit over 7 million. The interesting thing about this graph is that from the mid to late 80s, there's been relatively little collecting done. There's no way that you can account for the rise from a little bit more than 3 million accessions to over 7 million by collecting. You can only account for it by gene banks trading materials back and forth and by overduplication of existing materials. Also, we see that few of the gene banks were really intimately connected with use, with the user base. Here's a graph of gene bank samples distributed annually by the largest gene banks in the world. The first two on the left are actually from the CGIAR, and you have the larger bar there representing the materials that come out of the breeding programs of the CGIAR, and the smaller one out of the gene bank itself. I think really those should be combined because most breeders will want to get materials not directly from the gene bank but via the improved materials that they're getting from the breeding programs of the CGIAR. Nevertheless, when you go out to the right column, you see that the distributions from, albeit some of the major gene banks of the world, the farthest one on the right, if you can't read it, is Cartier, a regional gene bank in Central America. Even some of the large gene banks are distributing relatively few accessions on an annual basis. Bear in mind that these 10 or 15 on the screen here are only a small portion of the number of gene banks in the world, because now there's 1,700 of them. So if you think distribution is not so great from these, imagine what it is at the other end of the spectrum. So in addition, what we found in the mid-90s was, of course, that there was poor funding and unreliable funding. Now, a great deal has actually changed since the 1990s, the mid-90s. And the two things I want to highlight to you today have to do with the overall material context of the work in which we're engaged, and secondly, the institutional context. First, the material context. Since the 1990s, we've been aware that we're facing much more severe constraints in terms of land availability than ever before. In the mid-1980s, we really reached a watershed in the sense that the added production from our agricultural systems worldwide is now coming more from intensification of agriculture than from expansion of lands. That happened in the 80s. obviously we're not going to have a huge amount of extra land in the future to feed a growing world population. Energy use, we know that peak oil is coming as well. 54 of 65 major oil fields are officially in decline. The International Energy Agency, not a very radical body, is saying that we need to discover the equivalent of 4 Saudi Arabias by 2050 just to meet current demand projections. And all of this, of course, is related to the type of agricultural system we have, and ultimately even to fertilizer prices, which are very dependent on nitrogen, which in fact is of course linked to petroleum prices. Nutrients, we're facing peak phosphorus. You will have noticed if you read the financial newspaper that there's been a great deal of activity in the recent weeks with buy-ups of fertilizer companies in the context of declining supplies of some basic nutrients. Then there's water. 70% of fresh water supplies go to agriculture. Since the 60s, we've had a doubling of land under irrigation and a tripling of the use of water for agriculture. Probably we're not going to get a higher allocation in the future. And of course, during this period of time, we've seen a chronic underinvestment in agriculture, both at the national level and certainly at the international level. And then finally, there's climate change. I don't want to speak too much about that, but I will show you this one histogram that deals with South Africa on the left and Peru on the right. These are projections looking out towards the end of this century, and the projections are the average growing season temperature in those countries. It's, as you would expect, it's a bell-shaped curve, some summer growing seasons being cooler and some being warmer than others, and the top of the bell being the greatest number of growing seasons. But what you notice here is that the projections are that there will be very little overlap in the future. The historic temperature readings are the ones in blue, the projections for the future, the bars in red. And if you look closely, what you begin to sort of focus on is that the hottest growing seasons of the past will in the future be colder than the coldest growing seasons. So we know what kind of difficulty we faced in agriculture during extremely hot growing seasons in the past, and what we now have to realize is that those will be good years in the future. So in this context, what we find essentially is, particularly I think for the world of crop diversity and the use of crop diversity, is that we're under increasing pressure to use this very important natural resource. Now, at the same time that we have a greater need for genetic resource conservation and use, we have a new institutional framework that's been emerging in the last 10, 15 years. And it consists of 5 components, I would argue. The first is that we have a new international treaty. There are 122 countries that have ratified this treaty, and at least on paper, at least theoretically, it provides the legal framework for guaranteed access and distribution of crop diversity, at least by the parties that have ratified it. The second is that we have some very real strategies. We have a global plan of action that's been agreed by 150 countries in the mid-90s. I would say that it still reads pretty good. The Global Crop Diversity Trust, where I work, has been working with a number of expert committees, crop by crop, to formulate conservation strategies for those particular crops. And we have an agreed strategy for the type of work we're doing at the Trust, agreed with the governing body of the treaty, in other words, the 122 countries that are party to it. We also are beginning to have new and very potent information systems, several under development now. I'll talk about those a little bit later. And I have up on the screen transport. We have FedEx and DHL. And that means something quite profound in the world of crop diversity, because it means that we can access and send materials all over the world. We don't have to have a gene bank in everyone's backyard. We have the Global Crop Diversity Trust. I shouldn't say too much about that. I have a conflict of interest there. But I will say that I think it deserves to be on the page because it's a new structure. The trust is organized as an endowment fund. It's a new mechanism for matching up the long-term need for the conservation of crop diversity with a potentially long-term mechanism, which is an endowment mechanism. And finally, we have the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, picture of which was on the opening slide, which provides a secure international backup for existing gene bank collections. So all of these things are new and did not exist in the 1990s. What this means is that countries actually have a choice now. They have two options, I would guess. The first option is that they can build a national crop diversity conservation system as a standalone system. Every country could attempt to just suck in all of the genetic resources that it feels like it's going to need for the future and build a standalone system and not recognize any of the opportunities that might have been created from a new institutional framework such as the one you see on the screen. That would be one option. The second option would be to construct a global system based on a new situation created by these. The 1970s model of gene banks, which I think is what we have primarily in the world today, is of course that every country has a standalone system. And this is sort of the way I look at a standalone system. It's a system that's rather overburdened and probably not going to work. I don't think it's going to be workable or efficient or even sustainable. And it's certainly, in my view, not going to meet the demands of the 21st century agriculture. Not everyone, I would contend, has to do everything. The model of the 1970s was that every country was going to have a long-term gene bank, store their stuff, and have a bunch of breeders. They would access it from that national gene bank, and everything would be just fine. In effect, that system looks like this, with the little blue ovals being each national program or country. Everybody was going to do everything. I don't think, and we now have about 30 or 40 years of experience, I don't think this is actually an option. It doesn't seem to be working so far, and all of my experience in the last 30 or 40 years is that this system is crumbling and ineffective. It's an emperor with no clothes in many, many countries, and we might as well say it. We could visualize, based on a new institutional framework, that we could have international cooperation and come up with a slightly better idea of how to do things, and that would be this, based on a new division of labor at an international level. So what we really need is we need a global system that's rational, effective, efficient, cost-effective, sustainable. Now, I will acknowledge that all of those are politically correct and empty phrases, empty words, except that when you go to work or have the experience I did at the Trust, you have to begin to think about what those things really mean. What does it really mean to have an efficient, effective, sustainable global system? What would it look like? I think such a system has five components. The first is that each unique sample, and I underline unique, should be housed in a facility operating at international standards, and it should be backed up at the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. We need a minimum number of gene banks operating at international standards for long-term storage. We don't need 1,700. We have today maybe 30 or 35, I would guess. We certainly don't need 1,000. Having every unique sample in a poor gene bank, hundreds of them, backed up in Svalbard at the seed vault is not good enough. It'll bring down the seed vault, the management structure of the seed vault, the costing of that, and it's really not going to result in the kind of conservation and availability that all of us would want. So the first thing is that each sample has to be conserved in a facility meeting international standards, and second, backed up for safety purposes at the seed vault near the North Pole. The second thing is that each unique sample has to be actively managed and curated. The third is that we need good information about the samples themselves and good information systems. The fourth is that we need a timely provision of high-quality materials. Many gene banks promise this. Many gene banks, those of us in the field know, will tell you that they provide materials upon request, and they always meet those requests. This is not true. And we all know it is not true, and we know the countries that are not providing materials internationally. We need to build a global system around those who really are playing the game, not just those who are talking about playing the game. I know that's not politically correct to say it, but I think the stakes are a bit too high to ignore reality. And fifth and last, we need, of course, reliable funding. That's what we're trying to provide at the Global Crop Diversity Trust with the structure of the endowment, but I can tell you it's not easy. And I have mixed feelings when I read in the press just last week that countries such as France are now committing for next 5, 6, 8 years to provide $500 million a year in funding for biodiversity conservation. Japan has just announced that it's going to provide $2 billion a year, $2 billion for biodiversity conservation, and I do not believe a single dollar of either one of those is going to be directed towards conserving crop biodiversity, agricultural biodiversity. When I know from being in charge of an endowment fund and knowing what the costs are of the different gene banks, that we could conserve all of agricultural biodiversity forever for about the equivalent of the one-year contribution from France. So we need a global system that is focused on use, but let's face it, many plant breeders do not exactly sing the praises of the gene banks. And this, I think, is short-sighted, and it's ahistorical, but there's an important message here. And the important message is, why should plant breeders sing the praises of the 1970s system in a 21st century world? The gene banks have not gotten their act together and are living in the past by and large. I'm not singling out any particular gene bank, please. I'm talking about this from a global perspective, looking at the 1700 on the FAO list. So obviously, we need to redefine the international division of labor in terms of who does what with gene banks, nationally and internationally. We need to integrate far better than we have in the past breeding and conservation work. I think we need to reconceptualize the role of gene banks. That also is very much stuck in the 1970s. We need to be looking not just at serving active breeding programs, but how we're going to help farmers and farmer groups deal with the onslaught of climate change when there are no breeders and there are no seed systems in some of these different countries. And, of course, we need to tell our story. We need to define our goals and be more effective in our communication. So what's the problem? Why have we not been able to do that? I want to talk for a few minutes about the politics of this issue and the reality. Here is a slide which I was speaking in Brazil. I don't mean to pick on Brazil. I was speaking there a few months ago, and I showed this slide to them. I said, here's what you have been getting on average from, you know, internationally in terms of numbers of samples from other gene banks. And here is what you've been distributing to those gene banks. Many countries do this type of arithmetic. and would view it as a very good thing that that they're getting so many samples from the outside. But it's a little more complicated than that, because this shows you where those samples have actually come from. It's not just a numbers game, it's a diversity game. And what you can see is that Brazil, which is not atypical of countries, larger than most obviously, but not atypical, uses an international system, a global system, if you will, to access very different kinds of diversity than they might expect to find simply in Brazil. They're accessing diversity from all over the world. But access is a highly, highly political issue. And for some, the word access is synonymous with biopiracy. So let me show you this figure, and I'm going to ask you a question in a second. In the top row, let's pretend that you're a gene bank manager and your gene bank has sent 10 samples to a foreign gene bank somewhere. On the other hand, your gene bank has gotten 8 samples back from that foreign gene bank. I bet most of you have done the arithmetic already, haven't you? Did you do something in your head with those numbers? Here's the question. I can very often tell you what kind of politics you have by whether you added or subtracted. Because there are two different ways of looking at this. You can say, well, wait a minute, we sent 10 samples out and we only got 8 back, so we're down 2. Or you can say, we sent 10 out and we got 8 back, now we have 18. So are you minus 2 or are you plus 18? And my sense is that many countries are looking at this kind of exchange and saying we're down 2. When in fact, they ought to be looking at it and saying, no, we still have our 10. Now we have 8 more. Those are very different. The political implications of that arithmetic are very, very different. So there's a mathematics of access that's really a siren song to people in the political world. And this, I think, explains in part why we're having such trouble constructing a global system. At the Trust, we are partnering with a number of gene banks around the world to regenerate their threatened germplasm accessions. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And we pinpointed the collections that the crop experts told us were the most important collections in the world. And there were 211 of them. These are the collections the crop experts said are unique, not located in, for the most part, not located in CGIAR centers, not located in Fort Collins, very unique materials in developing countries. And if you look at the data that those collection holders supplied to us, here's what it looks like. Of those 211 collections, 129 of the 211 in recent years haven't been distributed at all internationally. And of the ones that have been distributed, those samples have been distributed very little. What I don't have on this pie chart is the fact that 48 of these 211 collections, there wasn't a single distribution of a single accession, even nationally. They weren't providing it even to their own breeders. How then can these gene banks ever hope to meet their mandate with such statistics? Access is not about biopiracy. Without access, diversity stays where it is. And when it stays where it is, in those 1,700 largely substandard gene banks, it's endangered. It's poorly curated and researched, poorly conserved, poorly documented, and in most cases, inaccessible to users. And countries simply lose the opportunity to benefit. So let me just show one of Daniel's nice bean slides from SEOT. I'm not going to talk specifically to this slide, but I want to have something on the screen rather than the last slide while I continue. When I joined the Global Crop Diversity Trust about 5 years ago, I had an experience that maybe many of you have had coming to a new job. I had interviewed for the job. I thought I contemplated quite a lot what the work was all about. I got the job. I came into my office. The secretary was already there. She had a clean desk ready for me. She had some notepads and some pencils on the desk. I sat down. She walked out and closed the door. And I thought, oh my God, what now? Because the day before that, it seemed like conserving crop diversity was fairly straightforward. And of course, one knows what one should do. But actually, no, that's not the case. And it's a lot more complicated than that. And what I realized pretty quickly was that the first thing I'd better decide was what not to do. Because in reality, there were 1,000 good things to do. There are thousands of great projects and wonderful, nice things to do with crop diversity. But if you try to approach it that way, you're going to fail, because the real challenge is to build an efficient, self-sustaining system. And randomly picking projects here and there, all these nice ones, is not exactly the way that you're going to arrive at that. So you have to start with what you've got, and what we've got is actually quite good. We have a rather well-functioning CGIAR system that's providing the bulk of germplasm internationally for breeders. We have a number of highly competent national facilities, such as the one in this country. Theo is here, the one in the Netherlands. And we can begin to conceptualize a global system as being built around this existing infrastructure where it's really working and not reinventing the wheel. The challenge then becomes to prioritize the few things out of the thousands of possible things that could be done to build such a system. So what we did at the Global Crop Diversity Trust was this. We realized that many of those gene banks were holding materials that were essentially dying, so we went to developing countries, made arrangements with them, provided them funding and technical expertise to regenerate, essentially to rescue, endangered germplasm. And that's a 4-year project. We're winding it up now. I think at the end of that project, we and our partners will have regenerated, essentially rescued, close to 80,000 different crop varieties. We put a lot of energy into characterization and evaluation of those materials. That's perhaps the part of our program I'm least happy with. I think that the technology is changing dramatically now, and that we're going to be able to do much more in terms of evaluation than we have in the past. And then, of course, we realized if we're going to have a global system, we need information systems. So we went to Candy Gardner and USDA, Peter Breding, is Peter here? There you are, Peter, great. With ARS, to look at reviving, making a new GRIN global system. It's been an incredible partnership with USDA. And that new gene bank management software system is going to be coming out shortly, in a couple of months. We've worked with Biodiversity International to develop another system called Genesis, which is a global data portal for uniting the information held in different gene banks and making that available, sort of a one-stop shop for plant breeders. And that's going well. We, of course, got quite involved with establishing and then stocking the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. There are now 526,000 accessions in the seed vault, more on the way, which provides not just something that the media seems to like a great deal, but a real safe place for germplasm collections. The media tends to think of it as a doomsday vault. I tend to think of it as a backup for those 1,700 very often poor gene banks in which we're losing material on a daily basis, but no more as long as we have it safety duplicated in Svalbard. We are endowing about 15 different crop collections around the world, essentially going to gene banks and making long-term in perpetuity contracts for the, with those institutions to conserve that material. And we can do that in perpetuity, if you will, because we have the endowment funds to back it up. We need to grow that endowment so we can expand that system, but we have a start. In the future, I think what we want to become much more involved with will be the area of crop wild relatives, a great underexploited, underexplored, and undercollected and conserved resource for the future, particularly in a climate-changing world. And information systems, we have to do much, much more in that regard. Now, what are we going to have to do if we're really going to create this global system I've been talking about? Well, we're going to have to act practically and politically to change the status quo. We're going to have to change the culture within our plant genetic resources world. We're going to have to build national programs based on the new context that I laid out at the beginning of this lecture. Just in the last year, several countries have announced construction of huge gene banks, not the type of facilities that you would necessarily need to build if you considered the global system to be a component of your own national system. But if you don't trust the global system and you really do think it's every man for himself, then build a big gene bank. So we have to get beyond that point and begin to look at how we can have every country buy in to not only having a strong standalone national program, but something that makes sense globally. If we don't, we really will revert to every man for himself. And we're going to have more and more marginal gene banks, more overduplication, more political pressures to fund dysfunctional gene banks, more of a drain on resources for the existing gene banks, and I think a decline in services to plant breeders, which is really what it's all about. I think we can succeed. I think we have a good strategy. We know what we need to do, but we will have to act with integrity, and both politically and organizationally, we will have to act with courage. I'll end there with an extra comment about courage, which is that I was privileged, as I suspect most of you were not, to know Calvin Sperling. He was a friend, and he and I shared something which was interesting and created a bond at that time. We both had the same kind of cancer. His situation did not turn out as well as mine did, obviously. We very often talk in the field of genetic resources about the big heroes in our field, and we always cite the case of the Vavilov Institute, of Nikolai Vavilov himself, and the workers who died, many of them starving to death, in the gene bank in Leningrad during the siege of Leningrad in World War II. And these are terrific heroes. But we have our own heroes, and Calvin Sperling was one of those. So it gives me a great deal of pleasure and a great honor to, in a very small way, to keep his name alive. Thank you.
Thank you, Kerry, for that challenging talk. I have an announcement that I neglected to make at the beginning. The CH section has, with the support of the Sperling Endowment, put together a small reception here for after the talk. So I hope you're able to stay around and enjoy some of the refreshments and have a conversation with Kerry and other members of the audience. The second thing is that we have a plaque for you as the 2010 Sperling Lecturer. So I guess on behalf of C8, I'm happy to present you with this, and hope that you will keep up the good work. And let's see, there's two more. I think I know I have questions. I hope we have time. Sylvia, what do you think? Do we have to be out of here at 5? Okay. We have, there was the Frank Meyer Medal breakfast this morning. I think I'll do this before the questions. Another one of the events sponsored by C8, honoring Daniel Dubuque. And they're actually, Daniel may not know this, but there is a medal that goes along. And but that medal, well, we was neglected to be passed. So, so with that, I'll ask Daniel and Bill Tracy. Yeah. Carrie, if you won't mind answering some questions, I'm sure. So let's open it up, and I'll let you handle the questions.
I'm not going to keep you from your drinking back there, but I know you need it. Okay.
The privilege. So you make a very cogent, coherent case for the creation of the new international system, but I worry about displacing a system that was, although it may be dysfunctional and may not work, there are pieces of that, I'm thinking of two pieces in particular, which I don't see in the international program, and I worry about that. I'm thinking of the recent efforts to establish in situ conservation programs and participatory plant breeding. Not necessarily intimately connected with gene banks, but certainly part of fabric of a whole system that was conceived originally and built carefully over a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to those pieces?
Well, I think we keep those pieces. I think what I've really been focusing on are would be the gene bank component, and in particular the long-term conservation part of the gene bank component. I think that gene banks in developing countries and some in developed countries as well can be transformed and pushed into this century, made much more user-oriented, be the gateway for plant breeders and even farmers in some cases to acquire new and needed genetic resources. But I don't think that every country has to pretend or even try to conserve material long-term in a climate-changing and interdependent world where we have a functioning genetic resources system at a global level and FedEx.
Could you elaborate on your comment about future improvements in your characterization and evaluation of germplasm?
Mm-hmm.
What information will we collect and how will it be maintained?
Well, I think that we're seeing developments in molecular genetics that will allow us to make projections and about which materials are potentially useful in certain situations, and probably to do a much better job of managing our existing collections. I know, for example, we've been going through a costing exercise where we've looked at the cost of gene bank collections, particularly in the CGIAR. And you can imagine, for all the obvious reasons, that the collections that are the most expensive to maintain are the vegetatively propagated collections. And that, we have to acknowledge that there comes a point where you really can't afford to say that we're going to try to conserve in perpetuity every single genotype that appears. That's a real luxury situation in the case we're in now. So I'm hoping that advances will at a certain point allow us to make distinctions and allow us to more intelligently manage the collections we have now. It's simply not an option that we're going to continue to grow this system. 20 years ago, 2 million accessions. Now, 7 million accessions. Where do we stop? Candy. I don't know if you heard it in the back. The question is, does the international treaty have an impact on whether countries decide to build gene banks or not? My answer would be so far no. Well, most countries do have them, and there's a lot of institutional and personal politics, and I didn't mention that, but by and large, I mean, one of the obstacles that we have in trying to make a rational system is that no one wants to be rationalized. And so therefore, if you look at an individual gene bank director coming to an FAO meeting, talking with somebody like me, I'm very often seen as the enemy. Why? Because I think we need a system that works at a global level and is rational. But that gets translated by a local gene bank manager as, I'm going to lose my job. And so what that gene bank manager wants, I mean, they're perfectly willing to go to an international meeting and endorse a statement saying we need an efficient, effective, rational, sustainable gene bank system. Sure, I'll sign off on that. But when the rubber hits the road, what they actually want is grant money to maintain their own gene bank, and I understand that. But there's a second option, and the option is really one that Steve was hinting at, and the option is to transform a gene bank which is not actually serving a conservation function and clearly, according to the data, isn't serving an access function. And by the way, is there another function that a gene bank has? Is to transform that type of gene bank into something that's a bit more modern and does serve some of those, does play a positive role. But that takes creativity, and it takes a certain amount of trust and a development of new relationships, which we haven't gotten to the point of yet. We would be very interested, frankly, at the trust in working with one or more gene banks to make that kind of transition and transition them from a 1970s-style gene bank, which is serving no particular function right now, into something that could be more productive. Yeah, absolutely. We're working in about 90 countries now, and we have regeneration projects in more than 40. And we had a couple of simple requirements. One requirement was that it had to be backed up into an actively managed collection operating at international standards. And we'd talk with them about which gene bank that might be, because we didn't want simply to regenerate that material and stick it back into the same conditions that caused the problem in the first place. So it had to go into an actively managed collection where we could be sure it would be managed properly and really be made available and safety duplicated in the seed vault and be made available under the terms of the international treaty. And there were a number of countries that said no to those requirements. And we said, okay, then you do it yourself. Not similar to what I've been talking about today. There, FAO has just done a similar publication on the state of the world's animal genetic resources, but for various technical reasons, you just can't manage that material quite the way you can seeds. Well, yes, but I'm not sure it's quite the impact that that many expected it would be or think it is. I mean, at least at our level, at the Global Crop Diversity Trust, we haven't found any huge impediments. But what it does is it creates impediments in terms of conservation and making material available and such. But I think it needs to be said that it's created a political atmosphere which is very difficult, and you sometimes get caught with the unintended consequences of that, which are very often not terribly positive. Wanda? You always used to ask me the toughest question, so I'm uh-oh. Well, there's no answer that I could give you, quite honestly, that would convince you that we could create a system like that, that at the same time would be a politically correct answer. If you look at the international treaty with its 122 governments, and you go to those meetings, which I do. And as valuable as I think the treaty is, it's not a forum for the discussion of technical and scientific issues. Countries are coming primarily with political representatives from ministries of foreign affairs and such, and not genetic resources people. So we need a different kind of forum. I think you're right. And if we were to look at creating a global gene bank system, I would start with the graph that I had up a little bit earlier of who is supplying the germplasm in the world. And if you want a system for conserving germplasm and making it available, let the marketplace speak. The marketplace is speaking. The biggest providers of germplasm in the world are the CGIAR, the United States, and a few other gene banks. Let's start with that and see what else we need to construct the system. Not forgetting some of the pieces that Steve mentioned quite appropriately earlier, but that's where you begin, and I think we need to think about having some type of a dialogue at that level. It's not a political level, Wanda. It's actually, the way I would make the distinction is, let's look where the unique germplasm is. And let's talk to the institutions that have the unique germplasm and then figure out how we conserve that. Yeah, I want to go over to this side just because I feel like I'm looking straight ahead. Dave in the back. Well, I could go into some detail on this, but we sort of feel like now that the unique germplasm in substandard gene banks has been regenerated and has been transferred or is in the process of being transferred to good gene banks, with a couple of exceptions. There were a couple of countries that didn't want to play the game. And those are still outstanding problems. But for the most part, it's been done. So I think that except for the materials that's still in farmers' fields or the crop wild relatives, that we have the in a good situation most of the unique germplasm in the world. So now we need to think about, I believe, the remaining gap is the crop wild relatives, and the remaining gap is, and is probably going to be for many, many years, the information systems. Yeah, I think that's exactly what should be done. Okay. Well, obviously we don't want to encourage over-duplication. That just costs a lot of money. But we believe that the facility that we have in Norway provides a level of security that's probably unmatched anywhere else. It's a black box facility. It's offered free by Norway. There are no distributions from that facility except back to the original depositor when they lose material. So, and it's more or less immune from mechanical breakdowns and such. It operates in permafrost, so it's minus 4.5 Celsius, even if there's no cooling equipment operating. So, our sense is that unique accessions, and that's a term that's difficult to define, obviously. Should be in at least one facility operating under international standards plus that backup. Otherwise, we don't think we have a very secure system. And right now, we have if you look at the reality of safety duplications, what you'll find is a great deal of material is over-duplicated. There are examples I know of where you could find essentially the same accession duplicated 200 times in a single gene bank, not even talking about other gene banks. That kind of situation is existing, whereas a number of accessions aren't duplicated anywhere. So it's going to take a lot of time to sort that out and get everything lined up. Okay, thank you very much.